Portland.
KVU's Metal Marathon, the Metal March, is back once again. And that means brand new metal merch. Go to kvu.fm/metal to check out all KVU's new metal merch featuring exclusive artwork provided by local artists and musicians at Unicron Artworks. This year's Metal Marathon is live on KVU Friday, March 14th at 8 p.m. through Saturday, March 15th at 6 a.m. Get your very own limited edition 2025 Metal March metal merch and listen to every installment of the Metal Marathon at kvu.fm/metal and support metal on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Dr. Adrian Pine of American University reflects on Trump's move to end asylum as we know it. Flashpoints media specialist Arun Gupta reports on Trump's criminalizing of free speech, and we feature our weekly frontline Gaza genocide report from the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barris Friedman. All this coming up straight ahead. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. As we do every Thursday, we bring you the Electronic Intifada newscast with Nora Barros Friedman. Listen to this.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Nora Barros Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 54 of the ceasefire. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. In Gaza, Israel's closures of all crossings has continued into the 12th day. Palestinians are reporting severe water and food shortages as Israel uses starvation as, quote, a weapon of genocide, as the rights group Al-Haq has stated. Al-Haq added that, quote, Israel's decision to reimpose a total blockade of all humanitarian aid entering the Gaza Strip, particularly during the month of Ramadan, is yet another example of Israel violating the ceasefire agreement and provides further proof of its manifest intent to eliminate Gaza's population by creating conditions of life calculated to bring about their destruction, in continuing breach of provisional measures of the International Court of Justice. The Palestinian Non-Governmental Network and the Association of International Development Agencies declared in a joint statement that the January 19th ceasefire, quote, provided a brief window for humanitarian operations to scale up. In just 6 weeks, aid organizations delivered food and medicine, reopened medical facilities, and launched vaccination campaigns. During this period, humanitarian actors demonstrated that when they are finally given an enabling environment, they can do their jobs and deliver. And Israel proved that enabling the delivery of aid was only a matter of will, a reality it has now underscored by choosing to use humanitarian aid as a negotiation tactic. The aid group Islamic Relief stated on Tuesday that, quote, aid trucks loaded with food and other essential aid are ready and waiting to enter Gaza, but are being blocked just a few miles from desperate civilians. Gaza's entire infrastructure has been systematically destroyed by Israeli attacks, including its ability to feed itself, the organization added. More than 80% of Gaza's agricultural land and more than two-thirds of its agricultural wells have been damaged or destroyed, and most cattle have been killed, leaving families in Gaza now almost entirely dependent on imported supplies. The scarcity has caused prices in local markets to skyrocket, making even the most basic necessities unaffordable for the poorest and most vulnerable. In a joint press briefing of UN experts in Geneva, Switzerland on Wednesday, Michael Fakhri, the special rapporteur on the right to food, asked, quote, how is Israel able to starve 2.3 million people so quickly and so completely? This is the fastest starvation campaign in modern history. Fakhri added that with Israel's resumption of the blockade on Gaza, quote, this is not a ceasefire by any definition. This is a slowing down of military violence, but an unfolding of death through starvation. He called for immediate and complete economic, political, diplomatic, and cultural sanctions on Israel to stop the genocide, as well as wide-spectrum reparations for Palestinians. Compounding the crisis, Israel's Ministry of Energy and Infrastructure announced that it was immediately cutting off the last remaining supply of electricity to Gaza on March 9th. Gaza has been under a mass electricity blackout since October 2023, except for the South Gaza desalination plant, which was reconnected to the electricity grid in November 2024, according to the United Nations. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, said on Tuesday that only 1 in 10 people in Gaza are currently able to access safe drinking water and that the situation has worsened after Israel's electricity cuts. The Gaza government media office condemned Israel's latest and ongoing cuts to electricity for Gaza. The continuation of these punitive policies against civilians, the media office stated, quote, constitutes a flagrant violation of international humanitarian law and exacerbates the suffering of the residents of Gaza, who are facing the worst humanitarian crisis in history. The denial of entry of construction materials, spare parts, machinery, and alternative energy systems has limited the municipality's ability to find effective solutions, deepening the crisis and threatening the collapse of basic services. Meanwhile, Israel continues to kill Palestinians in Gaza in spite of the apparent ceasefire. On Tuesday, Israeli forces attacked an area near Gaza City, killing at least 6 people in drone strikes near the former Netzarim corridor. An Israeli drone strike killed a Palestinian woman east of Rafah in the south, and Israeli soldiers shot and killed a Palestinian girl in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, according to Al Jazeera. Israeli forces also opened fire on homes in Khan Yunis. Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated on Tuesday that Israel has killed an average of 3 Palestinians every 24 hours since the ceasefire. Quote, the ongoing killings by the Israeli army are carried out by snipers and drones, including quadcopter aircraft, which target Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip. The deadly attacks frequently occur when residents attempt to return and inspect their damaged homes near the so-called buffer zone imposed by Israel along the Strip's northern and eastern borders, Euromed said. The Rafah governorate has faced the most Israeli targeting since the ceasefire, the human rights group added. Our contributor Abu Bakr Abed reported that Israeli troops in western Rafah were firing at several areas and in places where Palestinians were gathering on Wednesday, and that Israeli tanks were just a few meters away from displaced families sheltering there. Nearly 3 months after the Kamal Adwan Hospital in the northern city of Beit Lahia was raided and destroyed by Israeli soldiers, medical staff have set up a field hospital in the ruins of the hospital compound and are operating with minimal resources. The head of Kamal Adwan's obstetrics and gynecology department told Al Jazeera that there are severe shortages of medical and non-medical supplies and tools, and they are forced to care for their patients, including pregnant women with only basic care. The UN Agency for Sexual and Reproductive Health warned this week that the ongoing blockage of aid entry into Gaza is jeopardizing progress made since the ceasefire in terms of expanding sexual and reproductive health services and scaling up gender-based violence prevention, mitigation, and response. The agency also stated that, quote, compounded by widespread uncertainty and loss, the psychological toll of the last 17 months has further deepened people's vulnerabilities, including the risks of life-threatening pregnancy and childbirth complications. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight excerpts of Israel Left a Gift of Death in My Home by our contributor Rasha Abu Jalal in Gaza. Rasha writes that after 15 months of displacement, she returned to her home in Gaza City only to find it in ruins. She found a small metal box in the rubble with Hebrew writing on it and a key. Quote, I picked up the box trying to determine if it was a can of tuna or beans. My mind didn't comprehend it at first, but something was strange. There was no clear expiration date or brand name. When I lifted the box off the ground, it felt lighter than I thought it should have. This prompted me to recall the text messages that international organizations constantly send to my mobile phone, warning people not to tamper with any suspicious objects among the rubble of houses. At that moment, I felt a shiver run down my spine. I put the box down, then took a step back, then another. I immediately called the toll-free emergency number, 102. I explained the situation to the person who answered, and I was told not to tamper with the box, to leave immediately, and that a mine-clearing team was on its way. It wasn't long before two men in uniform, but without any equipment in hand, arrived. They introduced themselves as bomb disposal experts with Gaza's Interior Ministry. Next came the shock that made my legs wobbly. One of the men told me that the box was a trap, a bomb disguised as food. This is a gift of death that the Israeli soldiers left for the children of Gaza, he said. At that moment, I thanked God that I had not taken my five children home. I had left them with their grandmother at my parents' house in the Al Nasser neighborhood west of Gaza City. The bomb disposal expert said demining crews had found dozens of mines that were intentionally placed and others that were unexploded ordnance due to a technical malfunction among the rubble of houses. It is believed that there are still hundreds and perhaps thousands of these unexploded ordnances that have not yet been discovered. United Nations data showed that more than 90 people have been killed or injured by unexploded ordnance since the Israeli attacks began in October 2023. That's an excerpt from Rasha Abu Jalal's feature, Israel Left a Gift of Death at My Home, on electronicintifada.net. Turning to the occupied West Bank, where Israeli army raids and intensified settler colonial violence have continued in the northern region for more than 50 days, and where more than 30 Palestinians have been killed. These images we're showing are from a photo essay by Leila Warah and Wahaj Bani Mufle titled Inside Israel's Brutal Offensive on Jenin. The Palestinian Health Ministry stated that the Israeli army stormed the eastern and western neighborhoods of Jenin City on Tuesday and forced residents in an apartment building to leave, detaining them and interrogating them and ransacking the apartments. Israeli forces killed at least four people in Jenin on Tuesday, including a 58-year-old grandmother identified as Faiza Ibrahim Abu Galil. Israeli soldiers have continued to raid and attack areas in Tulkarem and the Nor Shams refugee camp. The Wafa news agency reported that on Wednesday, occupation forces deployed foot patrols around the camp, while bulldozers leveled another stretch of the street adjacent to its entrance, destroying infrastructure and civilians' property. Meanwhile, Tulkarem camp saw a heavy presence of military vehicles and infantry units. Israeli forces set fire to homes in the camp on Tuesday night. On March 7th, Israeli forces also stormed the ancient Al-Nasr Mosque in Nablus, reportedly setting fire to sections of it. The Associated Press reported that when asked for comment, the Israeli military said it was, quote, not aware of any fire set by soldiers at the site. Ghassan Daglas, the governor of Nablus, told the agency that, quote, they want to destroy the West Bank, Gaza, and everything. But the important thing is the resilience, the resistance, and staying on our land. We will rebuild in the early morning. We will restore prayer to Al-Nasr Mosque. And for the second time in a month, Israeli police again raided the educational bookshop in occupied Jerusalem. Police arrested the owner, Imad Muna, and confiscated dozens of books, according to Imad's son, Ahmed. The WAFA news agency reported, quote, after an hour and a half of conducting a raid of the shop, once again using Google Translate to discern the meaning of the titles on the shelves, the occupying forces confiscated dozens of books, arrested the owner, and took him to the Israeli police station on Salah Adin Street. They closed the shop door and took the keys to the bookshop and refused to explain what law had been violated or the reason for Muna's arrest. No arrest warrant or search warrant was provided. Included in the stack of books that were seized were authored by Ilan Pappé, Joe Sacco, Noam Chomsky, Jonathan Cook, Stephen Salaita, my colleague Ali Abunima, and myself. The Israeli police told media that they had, quote, received a report from a caller who stated that he had observed books containing inciting content at a bookstore in Jerusalem. Ahmed was eventually released and most of the books were returned except for three, according to the family. The Israeli police said that they have, quote, initiated a review of the books and based on the findings, a determination will be made on whether to refer the matter to the state attorney's office for further investigation into the suspected sale of inciting materials. Finally, as we always do, we wanted to share images of people expressing determination and resilience across Palestine. In Gaza, Sami Al-Madoun, a young musician in Gaza, performs the song Yama Hadudarna by artist Omar Al-Abdalat while sitting atop the rubble. The lyrics of the song include, O mother, they destroyed our home, my brother's and my neighbor's home. Don't be sad, O mother, we have gained more stones. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Well, the New York City Police Department has been busy today, made multiple arrests after dozens of activists swarmed Trump Tower in New York City to protest the immigration detention of a Columbia University activist. Chaotic scenes showed with NYPD officers dragging out members of the group Jewish Voice for Peace on Thursday. Meanwhile, Mahmoud Khalil, a permanent U.S. resident who is married to an American citizen and who hasn't been charged with breaking any laws, was arrested outside in his New York City apartment on Saturday. He faces deportation. President Trump has said that Khalil's arrest was the first of many. Joining us to talk about this, to talk about asylum, to talk about what's going on here, if it is in fact the end of the right to protest in the United States, is Professor Adrienne Pine. She has been, among other things, the coordinator of the International Coalition to Stop Genocide in Palestine. Professor Pine is a medical anthropologist who has previously taught at San Quentin State Prison, UC Berkeley, and the American University in Washington, D.C. She is co-editor of the book Asylum for Sale, Profit and Protest in the Migration Industry. Adrienne Pine, welcome back to Flashpoints. It's good to have you with us. And maybe why don't you talk a little bit about your response to what we're seeing happen? You've been on all sides of this angle of asylum and rights and immigrant rights. Give us some of your thinking on what we saw happen and the now beholding of Mahmoud Khalil.
Thank you so much, Dennis. It's great to be back. And I'll just add to my bio that I currently teach at the California Institute of Integral Studies in the Anthro Department, Anthro and Social Change in San Francisco. So it's nice to be speaking to a Bay Area audience, even though I'm joining you from Washington, D.C. I think with what we're seeing with Mahmoud Khalil, the important thing to understand is that this is not really about Trump. Of course, this is something that's happening under Trump and that Trump has exacerbated, but we need to look back just a year ago when students at Columbia University were being violently attacked by police, when the university welcomed that attack, when they had their when they had set up encampments in university property, that they've been being targeted. And this targeting is part of a broader, much longer term attack on free speech in academia that has paved the way for this kind of really blatant fascist attack against Mahmoud Khalil. And that broader attack is not, again, it's not a Trump attack. This is something that has happened under Democrat and Republican administrations alike, and has to do with the privatization of education, with organizations like the ADL, which are really ensuring that a Zionist narrative is the strongest narrative up and down all levels of education, and that speech against Zionism or in favor of Palestinian human rights is criminalized, and it has to do with the fact that with the privatization of education, what we've seen is the we've seen free speech really diminished because professors don't have job security, they don't have tenure, they're not able to teach critical thinking, they're not able to teach opinions that are unpopular to the major sponsors that universities need to bring in to fund their programs. So you get an increasingly really skewed kind of education. And that means a worse education. It means students aren't getting access to critical thinking. They're not getting access to the best professors because this process weeds them out. And they're being left vulnerable when they exercise their right to free speech on or off college campuses. So this lead up is what, you know, the people who have been most affected by this over the years are, of course, Palestinians. You know, you see one after another, when we've seen Palestinian scholars like Stephen Salada Finkelstein, right, lose their tenured positions. I mean, this was previously something that was sort of unheard of in academia, and now this is happening more often, where because of the complete neoliberal fascism that is really characterizes higher education in the United States today, it's become much more of the norm to be able to expel students for exercising legally protected free speech, to fire professors for exercising legally free speech, always when it is in favor of Palestinian human rights, right? Other kinds of free speech aren't targeted as much. And specifically, we've seen the targeting of Palestinian faculty and students for this kind of thing. Of course, it's also hitting others at lower rates, but this is an extension of how, you know, the way that Zionism works in Palestine, it's operating in our universities as well, because it's inseparable from the neoliberal restructuring processes that have happened in education over the years. And so the fact that this blatantly illegal and unethical and frankly fascist step of revoking the legal status of this young man has been taken should not really be seen as a break, but rather an exacerbation of processes that have been underway for decades in academia. And I think more than anything demonstrates the fact that academia has long been a space where fascism prevails.
Well, I think you're right. Exacerbation. In this case, they took somebody who was rather mild-mannered. He was a part of the pro-Palestinian movement. He's now a graduate of graduate school at Columbia University, and they hit him very hard. I mean, they threatened to arrest his pregnant wife, who's pregnant 8 months. This is a brutal, it seems like this was, they wanted to expand the message and send out fear. They wanted people to really be afraid.
Absolutely. And of course, it's worth reminding the audience that his wife is a U.S. citizen, and that this kind of state terrorism is really intended to silence protests overall. And I think it's important that you bring up that his activism, I mean, he was among really the milder of the, I mean, he was involved in negotiations. He's somebody who is very much working with everybody. You know, I mean, he is not, there's nothing, you know, he's being accused by the Republicans of being linked to Hamas, which is ludicrous. I mean, that is just simply not the case at all with this young man. Even the attack that the allegation that Hamas is uniquely a terrorist organization and people shouldn't be able to talk with it, that's problematic in and of itself, but he simply had nothing to do with it, right? I mean, he was coming from, I think, a more liberal place of a good faith negotiation, working hand in hand with Jewish students and advocates, and there's statements of his that have circulated about how Palestinian and Jewish liberation are tied up together. And so for them to go after somebody who was relatively mild, when of course there are students out there who believe in the Palestinian right to self-determination and even armed self-determination, but you know, if they're Jewish, they're not being targeted in this way. I think just reminding ourselves that this is something both that is a very, very much a racist and xenophobic attack that perfectly mirrors U.S. policy in supporting the genocide and structurally, and it does, of course, a lot of people are citing that poem and saying first they came for, you know, the gay people, and then they came for the Jews, and then when the Holocaust poem that everybody knows, but they've been coming, you know, we've been sounding the alarm, many of us in academia who have seen this creeping fascism for decades have been sounding the alarm for a long time. Thankfully, people are noticing with just sort of how horrific and egregious this abduction, this disappearance, the state disappearance of this young man was. But this is not something new, and people should have been fighting it a long time ago. It's we're in a dangerous place. There are not the conditions for free speech in academia. I would say there are some hopeful exceptions. You know, in the California State Universities, the faculty is unionized. That gives a tremendous amount of power to push back against this sort of violation, but the fact is most of the professoriate thinks of itself as being above labor, above unionization, and the fact that that fits in very well with a Zionist neoliberal agenda has left us in this position where we are, you know, now we've really gone past the tipping point. And so it's vital for us to fight tooth and nail, obviously, to not just protect this man, but to look at all of the other instances that are happening. Just yesterday, a professor was sanctioned, and I can't remember what happened exactly, but at Yale University, because yes. An AI app targeted her for supposedly supporting Hamas. Again, an absurd allegation. I think it's Helia Dutage. And so she was
gone in a day or so. No, she could not protest. There was no hearing. She was gone. Yeah. Disappeared.
Yeah. And I mean, so this is happening rapid fire. Students are being suspended. And Columbia announced that they are going to suspend they're going to reserve the power to suspend degrees they've already given. I mean, we're talking about such a blatant exacerbation of pre-existing fascism that has been enabled by this long-term privatization of education in this country, which is, of course, the culmination of this will be the, you know, Trump's attempt to destroy the education department altogether. And, you know, this works, this fits perfectly with a Zionist agenda, both of genocide in Palestine and producing fascism in the United States.
I just want to pick up on something you said. Again, this situation is sort of a bipartisan creation. I mean, the former Democratic president made the 2,000-pound bunker buster bomb famous with the amount that he was willing to ship under emergency circumstances to Israel to drop on people who were already living in their own dust from the former bombing. So that kind of brutality really did open up the door, didn't it, for a kind of violence we really never, we hadn't seen in quite a while.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that if we are going to be successful in fighting against fascism in the United States, we need to be honest that it's coming from both sides. Of course, the Republicans, many of them are what I would call ideological fascists. They really believe in the principles, many of the principles of classical fascism, whereas Democrats are neoliberal fascists. They have fought hard for a government that produces the outcomes of fascism without using its rhetoric. And they work hand in hand. And in order for us to, to really defeat this monster, we need to first and foremost recognize that this is an international struggle, and we need to take the lead from Palestinians. We need to take the lead from the global South, who have a harder fight than many of us in the United States, because we're in the United States. Although, of course, people who are more marginalized by U.S. racial capitalism here in the United States, Black people, Indigenous people, Latinx people, face a structurally similar kind of violence to people who are, really who are really oppressed by imperialism abroad. So we need to unify, and we also need to recognize that it's not about Democrats versus Republicans, because they are both promoting a fascist agenda, just with different rhetoric and very slightly different tactics. But Biden's genocide led us to the moment of Khalil being arrested by ICE, and of course Biden's asylum policies, his truly violent immigration policies that mirrored and exacerbated Trump's policies, also made this possible. They paved the way for this. So everybody gets up in arms about how awful Trump is, and he is awful. I mean, you know, but we got to remember that Obama still remains the deporter in chief, the person who, you know, deported most people as a president per year, and who started family separation. I mean, this is really a bipartisan effort, and we can't fool ourselves anymore about thinking that the Democrats are allies in stopping it.
We're speaking with Professor Adrienne Pine. She's the co-editor of Asylum for Sale, Profit and Protest in the Migration Industry. And I want to sort of turn the focus to the migration, immigration part of this. You want to talk a little bit about the kinds of fear and the way in which the Trump administration has scared the living hell out of everybody, and the kind of implications for that kind of policy. There are a lot of people who are afraid, a lot of people in hiding, a lot of people who aren't going to work, who aren't going to school, because they're terrified, right?
Yeah, and that terror is real, and it's legitimate. And it's the product not only of Trump's, you know, really increased efforts to deport people, but I think just as importantly, if not more importantly, the media frenzy that that has accompanied it. So there have been, of course, embedded reporters in the ICE raids. There's been all sorts of statements. There's, you know, it's been a really dramatic effort, coordinated effort to produce this sort of terror that migrants now, that people here in the United States are feeling as terror. And of course, you know, I do a lot of work both as a scholar, but also I work in asylum courts as a country conditions expert for Honduras. You know, I've seen a shift. Lawyers are much more scared in this environment, but also with the people in the immigrant community who I know. I mean, good friends of mine who had previously been working, like you said, they're afraid to go out of the house. It's the statistics don't bear it out. People aren't as much more at risk than they were under Biden. In order to sort of justify the level of fear that they have. But it's understandable that people have that level of fear, because it's really about producing terror with this combination of policy and media.
And again, of course, history is important here. You may know I once did a project, Trading Cards, Friendly Dictator Trading Cards, 36 of America's Most Embarrassing Allies. And it was all about, let's say it starts at the Monroe Doctrine, that the reason why people are still leaving, being forced out of their homes, is because they were forced by the United States government to live under dictators that were funded by the U.S. in the context of, this is our region, this is our backyard, and blah, blah, right? So this is part of the history.
Yeah, of course. All of the vast majority of migration, people migrating to the United States, is a product of U.S. foreign policy. And much of that is U.S. supporting dictators. You know, if we're going to look at Latin America, you know, you've got dictators like Bukele, who has also offered to take prisoners, to let us deport prisoners in U.S. prisons to El Salvador, since he's already imprisoned over 2% of the country in order to, you know, make the streets safe. So plenty of innocent people. We've got Milei in Argentina. They're violently going after pensioners right now. There's riots on the streets. I mean, he's, you know, very much, you know, an Argentinian Trump, and, you know, a lot of figures like that. But at the same time, you've got the countries that are standing up to this model, standing up to the violent export of neoliberal fascism are hit with economic warfare. So countries like, you know, Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela are being incredibly violently attacked, and that makes that makes their governments really unable to provide, because they're being blockaded entirely. They're not able to do trade with other countries. The U.S. sanctions other countries for trading them with them, and what that has done is to cause in some cases massive hunger, cause excess death to countries that are making an effort to actually treat their to be more equitable in the distribution of resources. And so countries are being punished for respecting human rights, and they are being rewarded by the United States for obliterating them. And all of this produces migration toward the United States because people can't survive under those conditions. And most people would prefer not to travel to a country where they know. I mean, the people, migrants aren't ignorant. They know what's going on at the U.S. border. They know about Trump's rhetoric. They know that people are being incarcerated merely for exercising their human right and international legal right to seek asylum. But conditions are so much worse in the countries that they're coming from that they're willing to risk that. And I'm glad that you bring it up, because it needs repeating again and again that that we're producing the quote-unquote migration crisis, that the United States government is producing it by creating conditions for neoliberal fascism, and in some cases outright fascism in countries abroad, and then we're punishing the victims of that international foreign policy.
All right. Well, Professor Pond, we're going to leave it there for now. We appreciate the incredibly good information, and your knowledge of immigration is crucial now, because there's going to be a lot going on, and who knows where this is going to end up. But thanks for taking the time out, and we're glad at least your voice is here in the Bay Area back again. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis.
Absolutely welcome. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back, and we're going to be joined by our media critic, Arun Gupta. He's got a lot to say about what's going on in the world at the moment. Stay with us. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're joined by Arun Gupta, who's a wonderful investigative reporter, and he's also a chef in another world. Arun Gupta, welcome back to Flashpoints. Good to have you with us. You've been keeping an eye out on what's been going on. Things are moving pretty quickly. Why don't you start with your sort of general overview? We've seen this high-profile arrest of a Palestinian, a leading Palestinian activist, a very mild-mannered person. Their family being put through hell, his wife 8 months pregnant. It is a brutal arrest, but it's part of the evolving policy of the United States. Talk to us.
Yeah, I think we need to look at this from a historical perspective, you know, both going back in terms of the American context, recent history, as well as kind of the history of right-wing authoritarian governments and fascist states. So I think one of the most important things that we cannot lose perspective of is that Columbia University was completely complicit in the kidnapping of Mahmoud Khalil. He had just days before his kidnapping, he had sent them a letter saying he was terrified and that he had been asking for help, for legal help, for support, and that he's, because he was being targeted by right-wing forces, just he was getting all these threats and hate mail. And he explicitly said he was afraid, you know, he was going to be attacked or ICE was going to come take him away. And Columbia University, apparently, they revised their guidelines. You know, ICE isn't just allowed to come into Columbia University. It's a private university. Columbia basically changed its guidelines to let them come in and disappear him. And so, you know, we obviously last year we were covering all the protests going on in New York City, and Columbia was a hotbed of the protests against the genocide of Gaza that Israel was carrying out with the full backing of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and that many elite universities, pretty much all of them, were implicated in one way or another. In Columbia in particular, there's all this overlap between the trustees, you know, the wealthy people who run Columbia, military contractors, surveillance companies. There's even overlap between faculty at one of the Columbia schools and the NYPD counterterrorism. So, you know, Columbia was being highlighted last spring as being this node in the nexus of the genocide and of state repression and terrorism. And what we find now is that Columbia is completely cooperating in this type of fascistic attack on democracy, on First Amendment freedoms. I don't think any of it should come as a surprise. You know, one of the things that students were highlighting is that these elite universities, they are not bastions and defenders of liberal thought. They are hedge funds that are controlled by millionaires with extensive massive real estate portfolios, and then these endowments that are completely implicated in the military surveillance state. So this is just an extension of that. And, you know, part of the story is also that the Trump administration had just cut $400 million in federal funding to Columbia with the dubious claim that they weren't protecting Jewish students. Of course, this Trump administration has literal Nazis in it. You have a Nazi saluting co-president, apartheid Elon Musk, who is affectionately known as Adolf Twitler. You have, the Reichsfuhrer, Stephen Miller, who is basically heading up this campaign of ethnic cleansing, you know. And so the Trump administration, of course, is full of far-right extremists, white nationalists, and Nazi sympathizers. Trump himself, if we remember, in 2017, after Charlottesville, after the neo-Nazi drove his car into the crowd of anti-fascist protesters and killed Heather Heyer, Trump said that, called them very fine people. You know, the exact quote was, they're very fine people on both sides.
Let's not forget that in terms of the Washington operation, you know, after he pardoned the folks who say the Jews will not replace us. Those are some of the nice people that he pardoned.
Right. You know, one of the people he pardoned was this guy who was wearing this. I believe it was a T-shirt that said Camp Auschwitz. Right. So he's literally.
I've seen. Yes.
So, you know, and then, yes. And of course, the Jan 6 coup, which was full of neo Confederates, and it was a white nationalist coup, you know, and there was all these neo Nazi elements, and including, you know, my fascist buddies from the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and who have, you know, encountered many times over the year, and we've talked about. So, you know, this is a context for which it's happening. Like, I'm not going to get into the legal stuff. I'm not an expert in this issue. You know, clearly there is, he is being targeted for political speech. You know, I think one of the things that we see now is just the complete Democratic Party capitulation to fascism. And I know, you know, it's just like the Democrats are the capos of MAGA. There was a letter that was circulated calling for his immediate release among Democrats in the House of Representatives. There are 214. Only 14 of them signed it, including from the Progressive Caucus. Only 14 out of 100 Progressive Caucus members signed this letter calling for his release. And we see Democrats, even now, after he was disappeared, you know, I refuse to call it an arrest. This is a disappearance in the way that Argentina or Chile used to do these things, or that Israel is doing this right now. That you see these Democrats attacking him as anti-Semitic and minimum questioning was, well, it should be determined whether he said anything anti-Semitic. Meanwhile, again, the Trump administration, and I think it's grotesque that we even have to have this discussion, but Khalil himself was so mild-mannered. And he, in fact, said, and this is a position I disagree with, that, you know, he called for a two-state solution and where, you know, Israelis and Palestinians can live together in peace with each other, you know. And yet I was listening to Bloomberg Radio a couple of days ago where they kept describing him as anti-Israel, you know. And so what we have seen is that for a year and a half, it was a Democratic Party, it was liberals, it was a liberal media, it was liberal academic institutions that completely paved the way for this fascistic attack, and now they are not standing up against it. And I've been saying for the last couple of weeks, you know, that famous Martin Niemöller quote about first they came for the socialists and I didn't say anything because I wasn't a socialist, then they came for the trade unionists, the Jews, on and on and on, and by the time they came for me, there was no one to stand up for me. And you know, that quote was supposed to be a warning, but the Democratic Party thinks it's a how-to manual, that basically they are going to let the fascist attack in every single way just run roughshod over the First Amendment, over the Constitution, over the federal government, and then after everything's burned down, they're going to be vote for us, vote us back into power so we can save, you know, democracy, even though it by the time that, if it happens, democracy will look like the Pacific Palisades burned to the ground.
Well, the spineless Democrats continue it. I don't know if you saw it. Chuck Schumer has decided that he's not going to oppose the Republic, you know, the spending bill, because it'll only be more trouble. This is somebody who I think Trump said yesterday that Schumer was actually a Palestinian. he wasn't a Jew. But
yeah, no,
I mean this is
remarkable.
Go on.
No, it's you know, this democratic capitulation. I was looking at the reporting in Politico. That's kind of the best place to go for inside baseball. Just a week or two ago, Democrats were saying, you know, if we can't show any backbone, if we can't stand up to this, then, you know, what are we doing here, right? And there was talk a week or two ago that they were going to refuse to approve this continuing resolution, and now they're completely surrendering to it, saying like, oh, it's going to be worse because then they can just choose what to fund and what not to fund, that they'll do more damage. And you know, and they're like, and we'll get the blame. First of all, that's ridiculous in terms of getting the blame, because the Republicans have the complete control. The public would just blame the Republicans. And secondly, it's just like, they're just going to hand power over to Trump and Musk. And the Democrats 2 weeks ago were saying, according to Politico, if we vote for the continuing resolution, this is just a tacit endorsement of what Musk is doing. So there we go. They're going to basically...
And they, it's really... it's like watching a massive public mugging. They're rolling the United States of America, and the Democrats are hiding. It's an extraordinary thing. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Arun Gupta. We're talking about, well, the politics of the moment, which are frightening. I know we don't have a ton of time left. I know you've got a couple of suggestions, Arun, for what people should be doing now, what kinds of actions, what kinds of stance folks should be taking. You want to talk about that?
Okay, sorry, I hear you, Dennis. Are you there?
I'm here. Did you get the question?
No, I didn't hear the question. Could you say it again?
You have a list of suggestions of things you think people should be doing now to take on the emerging fascism. You want to talk a little bit about the list?
Yeah. So on my Substack, you can find it, Arun Gupta, Life, the Universe, and Most Things. You know, I think the arrest of Khalil is what I call a galvanizing moment. It's where, you know, in New York City in particular, you see thousands and thousands of people in the street. Now, this is incredibly vital. I'm not going to say, can we win this battle? I'm not sure, because this is, and the ACLU is like, oh, this is un-American. And it's just like, ACLU does a lot of good work, but I'm sorry, this is very American, right? You know, the Alien and Sedition Act of 1791, you know, the Palmer raids during around World War One, McCarthyism, of course, you know, after 9/11, the anti-Muslim hysteria, roundup and deportation. This, and Palestinians have been persecuted since the 1990s, you know, by the U.S. Federal government. There have been all these cases like this. So this is very American. But this is a galvanizing moment, right? Because the terrain that we fight on, and by we I mean the left, the socialist left, the communist left, we have to build social power, right? These things are not about laws, because that's what Trump and Musk are showing. Everything you're doing is completely illegal. They're treating the Constitution like it's toilet paper. And when you have power, you can do what you want. And Trump is like, basically, c'est moi, I am the state, right? You know, he's basically said that outright. So we need to build power. And we need to bring in as many people as possible. And that includes all those who are disgusted by politics, and also liberals who are disgusted by the Democratic Party capitulation to elites. Now, the thing about galvanizing moments is they can turn into disruptive moments. And Those include, in recent history, Occupy Wall Street, the Standing Rock pipeline blockade, the George Floyd movement, the student movement encampments for Gaza. These disruptive moments, they're called that because they disrupt business as usual, the functioning of parts of society or the state, and they all shifted the political debate to the left. Now, granted, the outcome of all these was a mixed bag at best, but nonetheless, that has
30 seconds.
How well do we organize? But I think the main thing is we need a total break from the Democratic Party. And I'm not talking about third parties here. We need to build our own independent political and social power. And that doesn't mean we can't negotiate with the Democrats. We should continue to pressure them and force them, but stop voting for them, stop donating money for them, stop doing door knocking for them. They are worse than useless. They are collaborators in our fascist.
Well, don't hold back. We're out of time. That's Arun Gupta. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Thank you, Arun. We'll talk to you soon. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Jill Fritz with the Humane Society of the United States. And you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.